Hello and welcome to The Opening Bell, the boxing news podcast. Matt Christie and John Dennen are here again.
What up?
Okay, so we've got to talk about the weekend's action that has just passed. Chris Eubank in the headlines, arguably for the wrong reasons, or the fight he was involved with in the headlines for the wrong reasons, in that it was, in every sense of the word, a mismatch. He blew away Tony Jetta in Sheffield. John, you were there. We didn't expect a lot from the fight beforehand. Tony Jetta, 39 years old, fringe contender, would be being very, very kind to him. What were your impressions of the fight while you were there?
I think, you know, like everyone, disappointed in Tony Jetta's effort, but then I don't think I expected much more from him. I doubt many of us really did. At least it was more that Eubank did his job effectively enough. Sometimes we've seen him against journeymen showboating, which is a bit of fun, but other times he can get a bit sort of carried away and smother his own work or kind of swing himself off balance. So we saw a Eubank Jr. who looked dangerous and efficient, but you know, this fight didn't really tell us anything that we didn't know already.
It wasn't, considering he'd been out for so long, it wasn't really any preparation at all for a fight against Spike O'Sullivan. You sensed that he'd probably got more out of sparring sessions than he did. And he did that fight itself.
Yeah. Though his father told us afterwards that he could see the ring rust being shed already. And it is sadly, I mean, these mismatches tend to happen a lot in boxing. You know, a marking time fight that's very easy to not jeopardise, a bigger fight coming up.
Who do we blame for the mismatch? Was it Matchroom for making the fight? Was it Matchroom for elevating the fight to main event status after Kell Brook was forced to withdraw from his fight against Diego Chavez? Or do we blame the governing bodies who, as we mentioned in this week's issue, it wasn't just, although the completely needless and pointless WBA interim strap was briefly at stake, it wasn't just the WBA that had him ranked in their top 15. I believe the WBO and the WBC also had 39-year-old Tony Jetta in the top 15. Who do we blame for a fight like this?
Well, I think there's a bit of blame to go around. Yeah, it's surprising that he was, really surprising that he was so high with all those sanctioning bodies. So it's kind of natural. It's kind of, you know, a natural fight to make. Just to get Eubank an easy win under his belt. And obviously the promoter has to shoulder some of the blame because it was a predictable, one-sided win for Eubank Jr. But it was never meant to be the main event. That was going to be Kell Brook, Diego Chavez that fell through. So I wasn't like, you know, I didn't like it, but I was never bored, and it wasn't the worst thing we've ever seen in a boxing ring. Sadly, boxing probably can throw up worse fights.
What alternatives did Matchroom have with 8 days to go? There wasn't much they could have done at that point, bar perhaps putting Gavin McDonnell at the top of the bill instead in a European title fight. The European title, the EBU, I believe, is a far more worthwhile title than the WBA interim title.
Yeah.
I guess you could also say the problem there is that, like it or not, Chris Eubank Jr. is a much, much, much bigger name.
Yeah.
And he's an easier sell, no offence at all, to Gavin McDonnell.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're probably getting too hung up by what was the main event in the European title fight was the proper fight on the bill, definitely worth watching. And there was a good fight on the undercard that we thought would be a good one ahead of time. It really was. That was Atif Shafiq versus Jamie Robinson, who really went for it. Yeah, so maybe we're getting too bothered about what's normally the main event, because I think, unfortunately, whoever's most famous is going to probably be the main event. Most people on TV, not boxing fans, but you know, casual observers will have known the Chris Eubank Jr. name, and hopefully everyone else would have tuned in to see the likes of Gavin McDonnell and Matthew Shafiq.
As you say, it's
as the show as a whole, I was never bored.
Yeah.
So because at least Eubank Jr. got his job done, you know, mercifully quickly, and you know, the Eubank show where he's just staring, like, you know, staring into the crowd and leaping over the ropes and all the showboating, you know, maybe it's a guilty pleasure, but it is quite entertaining. You know, that was over quickly. McDonald's in a really good fight, and it fit in the night, finished with a really good fight. So I didn't, you know, what other choice did they have? If in the first place they'd had Eubank against a better opponent, that would have been better, because even when Eubank Tony Jeter was made, the general reaction was, you know, he who. So they could have done with having him, you know, having a stronger opponent from in the first place. But then when Kell Brook fell through, and you know, they were offering refunds, the show went on. You know, gave me something to do on a Saturday. So
it's not the first, as you said earlier, it's not the first time there's been a mismatch. Apparently at world level, at the top of bills. I mean, I remember Joe Calzaghe was in one or two easy fights when he was WBO champion, and we've seen it before. We've seen it, and we will continue to see it.
But I didn't feel the show was a waste of time. So I hope hope people will read my report in the magazine and see what
it is actually a very good report, John.
Oh, mate, your editor's letter is very good.
You haven't read it, so. Let's.
I don't need to tonight. So.
Let's. Just one more thing before we move on from Chris Eubank. One of the most fascinating things for me beforehand about this contest was the introduction of Adam Booth to the team. I spoke to Ronnie Davis briefly this morning. He seems relatively happy with the whole setup. He says that Chris will spend 3 days still down in Brighton training with just Ronnie, and then he'll go off and he'll spend 3 days training with just Adam. Did Adam Booth, was the fight long enough to get any indication of what Adam Booth brings to Team Eubank?
Not really, though Eubank Jr. did say afterwards that they only had one break after the first round, and Eubank Jr. did say afterwards that the corner ran perfectly. But it was interesting in that before the fight, rumour swirling round was that Eubank Senior, or English as I now call him, was going to be in Junior's corner in his suit, and Adam Booth was going to be in the crowd. That turned out to be just a rumour, but I was watching with interest what was actually going to happen in the corner. As it was, English was sitting in the front row, and Adam Booth was like sort of in control of the corner, which, you know, he's an excellent corner man, that's what you want. So in seeing who was in charge during the fight itself, that sort of bodes well for the future.
Okay.
But it's quite, you know, it could be quite a fearsome combination.
I think
Eubank Senior working his magic, Ronnie Davis there, and, you know, if Adam Booth, if Eubank Jr. is listening to him, which he probably will, you know, we could start to see that sort of potential converted into results.
It's certainly going to be interesting to see what happens next. Elsewhere, Terence Crawford put on a pretty impressive performance.
Yeah.
On Saturday night. But I mean, we and you specifically now, you're head of the website and everything else, you will monitor figures. There's not that much interest out there for Terence Crawford, is there? And it's a fairly good indicator when we're looking at our web traffic, isn't it, as to what's really pushing people's buttons. Yeah. And Terence Crawford at the moment, through no fault of his ability in the ring, is not.
Yeah, which did come as a surprise to me this weekend, because Terence Crawford, he is one of the best boxers in the world. You know, he's talented, he can be a ruthless finisher, you know, and he's being viewed certainly by Bob Arum as a potential opponent for Manny Pacquiao, and yet he hasn't seemed to have caught on with the wider boxing public, even though he, you know, he has tremendous local support in Omaha, so yeah. There's a great atmosphere when he fights. I'm surprised he hasn't sort of caught on, because he, you know, he is an American champion, whereas, you know, compare him to Gennady Golovkin the weekend before, everyone was talking about that, everyone was tuning in to watch it, lots of people, you know, there was a huge appetite for, you know, material about Golovkin, in a way that wasn't for Terence Crawford, which, you know, which I think we've touched on it before in the podcast, which I think is a problem for him, because if he wants the super fights, he's got to start, you know, maybe he's got to be slightly less reluctant to do an interview or do something to get attention.
It does seem to me that the fight against Manny Pacquiao makes sense for many of those reasons. It's not going to be as big as Mayweather-Pacquiao, of course it's not. But is that the perfect fight now for Terence Crawford, and would you favour him to beat a 36-year-old Manny Pacquiao?
I probably would. You know, I think, you know, then what? Pacquiao fought Algeria at catchweight at 144 pounds. I wonder if they do that again rather than going all the way down to 140. So that's a sort of, you know, I don't know who that will favour. Maybe the sort of power of Pacquiao will come through more. But I think Crawford is very tough to beat. He's fast and slick, so I probably would favour him to beat Pacquiao. But also, that fight does everything for Terence Crawford. He needs it so much more than Manny Pacquiao. I mean, probably at this stage in his career, yes, if in terms of taking the best challenger out there, there's an appeal for Pacquiao, but he doesn't need it in the way Crawford does.
But even if Pacquiao was to lose that, would he not get credit in a way that Floyd Mayweather, for example, didn't get credit for his last fight? Floyd Mayweather seemed to take what was largely perceived as an easy option against Andre Berto. Manny Pacquiao, and I think I'm right in saying, he's lost a little bit of his luster because of what happened in the Floyd Mayweather fight, and perhaps more so what happened afterwards with the announcement that there was an injured shoulder and everything else. You say that Terence Crawford is doing everything for Terence Crawford, but if Manny Pacquiao was to come back and beat Terence Crawford, or even go out and put in an absolutely wondrous, typically gutsy performance, would that not be the perfect punctuation mark on Manny Pacquiao's wonderful career?
Yeah, he would get a lot of credit for that, definitely. But then if he fought someone like Amir Khan, I the problem is, if he chose not to fight Crawford and went for someone that would be more, you know, make for a more exciting fight and a more exciting build-up, like Amir Khan, and everyone thought it was going to be an explosive fight with a knockout, you know, I don't think anyone would begrudge him not choosing Terence Crawford. Plus, factor in, they are technically not in the same weight division, even though people think Pacquiao should come down.
Okay. Fair enough. This weekend it's fairly quiet. I say it's quiet. I think there's something like a dozen domestic cards going on up and down the country. I think we had a couple last night, and they continue over the weekend. But really, over the next 7 days or so, arguably the most interesting fights are crossroads fights, almost, in the heavyweight division, the kind of changing and evolving heavyweight division. Coming up this weekend, we've got Tony Thompson against Malik Scott. The winner of that one can make a case for being, you know, top 10, perhaps deserving a title shot, maybe.
I'm sure he will, but
I mean, the last thing you want to see, really, is Tony Thompson, Vladimir Klitschko 3.
Nice.
But Tony Thompson against Deontay Wilder is something interesting, I think, in terms of Wilder's education. And next week we've got a WBC eliminator between Alexander Povetkin and Marius Vak. That is perhaps the better fight,
yeah.
Povetkin-Vak. Both guys have lost one-sided decisions to Klitschko. both are still in the mix. Povetkin has certainly shown the better form. Vak, throughout his career, hasn't really beaten anyone of note. Certainly no one at their peak. What do you see coming out of this whole situation?
You know, I think Alexander Povetkin, he's almost getting himself ready for the fight with Deontay Wilder. He's got a big, you know, a big tall opponent to practice on, who I'd expect, or maybe, yeah, I think, like, if I think Povetkin could look good, he certainly has recently, and again, if he looks good again, he's going to suddenly look like a very dangerous opponent for Deontay Wilder. Tony Thompson, Malik Scott does nothing for me. Like, there was all, you know, there's this murkiness around Tony Thompson.
Yeah.
Failed a doping test, but could have got a therapeutic use exemption, didn't. But this all went on, you know, unbeknownst to the world until his supposed ban had passed, which all leaves a very bad taste. And then you're thinking, you know, you don't really want to be seeing him in the sport, or at least not at the high level like this. Well, not trying to get to a high level. Malik Scott, he lost tamely to Deontay Wilder, lost to Derek Chisora a while ago. But the winner of that is probably going to get, is probably going to get a fight with Deontay Wilder, which is, you know, just enough of this nonsense.
Okay, let's move on from that. I can see it's threatening to send you into depression. Okay, so all those things we've talked about are what we go to in depth in the magazine. We also have this week in-depth interviews with Don King. That one in particular is entertaining, bizarre, and I don't know what the words are really. You would need to read it. He's pretty much asked everything that we would want to ask him. He explains everything from his crazy hair. He addresses accusations that that he's a bit of a crook in terms of his payments to fighters. He also talks about that rather infamous scene when he tried to seduce the Klitschkos by pretending to play a piano. And it turned out that it was just a recording of the music in the background and not Don King at all.
Klitschkos were too impressed with that.
They were not at all, no. But Don King goes into detail about all of those things in that interview. We also catch up with one of Britain's latest world champions, WBO light middleweight boss Liam Smith. So well worth reading again. Cracking amateur section as per. Since the magazine has come out, there's a few things. A few little bits and bobs of news that we may want to talk about. The Cotto Canelo fight is impending, November, Mandalay Bay, Las Vegas. We have spoke about that fight before. We'll probably speak about it again in depth a little bit closer to the time. But the undercard starts to look quite interesting.
Yep.
Lee Haskins gets his shot at the IBF bantamweight title against Randy Caballero.
Yeah.
Who beat Stewie Hall for the title. Tough fight for Lee Haskins. It's been a long time coming as well, this kind of recognition for Lee Haskins, and he's got it on a pretty big stage as well, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm pleased for him.
Yeah, he definitely deserves the shot.
Do you give him a chance?
I do, because he's a very awkward, he's got a very difficult style, but I don't know, the judges over there might not like it. But you know, you look at some of the people Haskins beaten in the past, so I think he's up there. He's up at that level. But I think, yeah, in America, you'd probably think Caballero is going to win that. But I expect it to be a proper.
It's almost 50-50, isn't it? Almost,
yeah.
50, maybe 60-40 in the champion's favour. Yeah. Also, in the last day or so, it's been confirmed that Andre Ward will appear on that bill and make his official light heavyweight debut. The bout against Paul Smith was some weird catchweight thing, I seem to remember.
As in, he was under light heavyweight
and Paul Smith came in as some ludicrous.
Yeah. Is that a catchweight? I don't know. It's something.
So we don't know who Andre Ward's opponent is as yet.
Less than a month, it's not going to be.
It's not likely to be someone huge. No, but the fact that he's making that move to light heavyweight is making it's encouraging for future matchups against the likes of Sergey Kovalev is the first one that springs to mind. Adonis Stevenson, perhaps, and further down the line, maybe the likes of Beterbiev. Is this the right place for Andre Ward, light heavyweight rather than super middleweight? There is a feel that he's cleared that out. He's done all he needs to do, really, in that division to prove himself, hasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. He's done everything he need. He's done everything there is to do at super middleweight. Obviously, James DeGale's on the scene now, and that would be an interesting fight. But, you know, Andre Ward was recognised as the number one super middleweight for a long time, one of the best boxers in the world. The appealing fights for him are at light heavyweight. You know, Kovalev's a great fight. Plus, it's been such a long time since he made the super middleweight limit. He was a light heavyweight as an amateur, so I think it's time to move up and finally get. You know, he hasn't had a big fight since beating Karl Froch, has he?
No. So it's seems like a long time ago.
We were young then, man.
I remember that night. I remember where I was that night, and a lot has happened since that night. Yeah, it was a long, long time ago.
I picked Karl Froch to win.
Yeah, I think I may have done as well. What's that say?
Carl Frampton, Scott
Quick. Oh yeah,
Quick.
Of course, yeah.
Fight isn't made yet, but they're getting closer to the finish line.
You spoke to Eddie Hearn last week, didn't you, last Saturday, and he said something along the lines of, if it's not resolved soon, it never will be.
Yeah, but the optimism is there. I asked him on a scale of 1 to 10, if Karl Frampton, Scott Quigg was definitely happening, that would be a 10, and if it was definitely not going to happen, that would be a 1, and where is it on the scale?
I don't think you needed to explain that. I think people would have... I think even Eddie would have realised what...
I like the sound of my own voice. No, he didn't actually understand it because he said 2 and then said, oh, no, I mean 9.
Okay.
And that was on... So that was late Saturday night. Since then...
So in case people didn't understand, if Eddie Hearn said 9, what does that mean?
That means it's close.
Ah, I see.
That's a long way of saying it's nearly there.
Okay.
But I've heard since then that it's getting closer and closer. But it's not done yet. It'd be good if it happens though, innit?
Do you think there's a danger that we're over this fight already? It's been mentioned more or less since they were... When both their careers was in their infancy, they've kind of been associated with each other. They both have kind of gone along a very similar career path. There's been one or two common opponents along the way. But it seems to me we have been talking about this for such a long time.
Yeah. Well, they've certainly been linked with each other for such a long time, and rival camps failed to see eye to eye for such a long time. But we've probably spent most of this time talking about will they, won't they, what the sticking points on the negotiations are. I think once the fight's actually made and we all start talking about what's actually going to happen in the fight, which has probably got more and more interesting, as in, you know, Scott Quigg looked fantastic against Kiko Martinez in July, whereas Carl fighting on the same day had his hands full with a sort of really, really not well-known or an unheralded Mexican. So the ins and outs of what's going to happen in the fight itself, who's got the advantages in which department, you know, they're two train, you know, Joe Gallagher versus Shane McGuigan as a sort of trainer matchup is great. And, you know, who knows, you know, whether it's all going to be all smiles between Barry McGuigan and Eddie Hearn, you know, because they just don't do things the same way as each other, so that I can't see them getting along. So the whole build-up, I think, is going to be interesting. And the fight itself, you can sort of endlessly there's so much to discuss about how it's actually gonna go. I think people are gonna be quite split on who they think's winning. Maybe more split now after their July 18 fights than they would have been before. So I think if it's actually, or once it gets made, if it gets made, then it will, you know, come back to life. You're not you don't look happy.
I am. I'm happy. It's Friday afternoon.
The weight of the world hangs heavy on your shoulders.
It does. It does. No, I'm fairly chirpy. Although I rarely look happy.
It's the whole face.
Even when I'm giggling.
Oh no.
It's my unfortunate face, I'm afraid.
You look like a jackal about to feast on a.
And what?
Carcass.
Wouldn't they be happy about that?
Yeah, but they wouldn't look happy.
I hear you. If Quigg Frampton happens, it's exceptionally likely to end up on pay-per-view.
In a world where Anthony Joshua Dillian White is seriously considered for pay-per-view, surely Frampton Quigg.
Well, this is the thing. That's what I was moving on to. Now, there would be understandable, I think, disappointment if Joshua White was to end up on a pay-per-view platform, and that, reading between the lines, looks the way that that's going to go. Would people be justified in their anger if Quigg Frampton ended up on a pay-per-view platform?
I think Quigg Frampton would be one of those fights, one of the sort of special fights that you think belong on pay-per-view, because to make it, because also it's been a difficult fight to make, so they probably need a big pie to share out to actually make the fight happen. So I think with that fight, you could argue if it wasn't going to be on pay-per-view, we wouldn't be getting it. Which, you know, is not an argument you can really make for Dillian White, Anthony Joshua.
You can understand Matchroom's thinking and Sky's thinking with loading the Joshua Dillian White bill with decent undercard fights.
I did enjoy the May 30 show, which was pay-per-view, which was sort of stacked in the way they might try and stack this December 12 one. That was the Kell Brook Frankie Yan was the main event, but it had some cracking fights on the undercard.
I mean, they'd have to go some to get some fights like that. I mean, yeah. December 12th now is what, 6 weeks away?
6 weeks away.
So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they'll come up with some, they'll get some good matchups there. But putting Anthony Joshua on pay-per-view, I mean, how many fights has he had? 12, 13?
He's had 13.
13, so it's 13 knockouts. If we're honest, I mean, he's met a couple of guys that you could kind of class maybe as gatekeepers. So he hasn't met anybody in the top 10. And already he's being put on pay-per-view. From Matchroom's point of view, from Sky's point of view, Joshua is undoubtedly one of the most appealing fighters in the sport at the moment. He's got crossover appeal that a lot of other fighters haven't, in that he will draw in casual fans just by being a giant that knocks people out effortlessly.
And he is good.
And he's brilliant. And he's absolutely brilliant. But is this the right time for him to move up to pay-per-view, do you think, John?
Well, I would say no, because, you know, it's a British title fight. Anthony Joshua won the Olympics on BBC with the world watching. It would be great if he could fight for the British title in front of most of the country. And I think it's probably to his advantage not to be locked away on pay-per-view now, because if Anthony Joshua, Dillian White, is on sort of a more accessible TV channel, everyone is going to watch it because of the animosity between them. It's going to be huge. Everyone was talking about the Gary Cornish fight. There was a real buzz. And that must have been because a lot of people saw it. You know, so we're not, given his popularity, given the way the boxing business is, probably sooner rather than later, Anthony Joshua is going to be on pay-per-view. But it would be nice if as many people as possible could see this fight, especially as, you know, if he looks good in it, which I expect him to, and probably a lot of people expect him to. But a lot of people see that he'll bring all those people along with him for the rest of the journey, for, you know, getting to world level next year. So it seems long term more in his interests, maybe more in Sky's interests, to just not rush it. Don't rush headlong into making a pay-per-view because Anthony sells a lot of tickets.
Yeah.
Maybe try and, you know, build that support base. Because, you know, if everyone sees this fight on December the 12th, you know, maybe Anthony, you know, and if Anthony Joshua wins, maybe he'll be fighting for a European title in February on the Quigg Frampton bill, and then you've got a massive pay-per-view that I'm sure will make all the business people very happy. My hope was that, because this December 12th, whether it is going to be pay-per-view or not, is undecided at present. So maybe if Frampton Quigg gets made, they'll think to themselves, you know, February's only a couple of months after December, hold fire on the pay-per-view.
I would hope so, and then they can build those fights that they want. And I kind of agree with what you've just said there, to be honest with you, John. I'd like to see Joshua being on a normal Sky Sports platform for the next fight. You can understand what Matchroom was saying when they say, well, look, we wouldn't be able to make the fights we're going to make if it wasn't on pay-per-view, but is it absolutely essential to load the undercard of Joshua White? Do we need all these other big fights on as well? Is Joshua White not a big enough fight on its own to appeal on Sky Sports?
Yeah, because, you know, even Joshua Gary Cornish, that was a big night, a good crowd, I think, you know, certainly just from the buzz around it, a lot of people watched it. You know, Joshua White alone would bring in, you know, a lot of eyeballs.
I think either way, December the 12th is going to be a card that we'll be very interested in.
Maybe it's because the tickets sold so quickly.
Yeah,
they think in pure business terms.
Yeah, which you can't knock them for thinking that way, can you?
No.
You can't knock them for thinking that way.
If we were in the hot seat, if we were making a decision and you had the choice of, you know, long term, you think you'll be better off, but right here, right now, you can grab some money.
Quick win. Bunsen burn, a nice little earner.
What would you do, mate? Your decision.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? It's a difficult one. Of course, I'd find room for it somewhere on terrestrial television. That's what I'd do.
I'd take the money and have a massive Christmas.
Go nuts. Go freaking ballistic. Okay, right. We've been talking for coming up to 35 minutes. We're going to have to leave. We are still putting the annual to press. I think we've got about an hour and a half, 2 hours left to do that. So we're going to have to go and do that. But thank you, everybody, for listening and for your continued support. Please go out and buy the magazine. There's been a few changes that I've been making over the last few weeks. So if you haven't picked it up for a while, go and have a look at it and let me know what you think. And we'll be back, fingers crossed, next week. Take care.